This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry in for Tanzina Vega. And this is the late Representative John Lewis of Georgia speaking in 2018.
Many people marched and protested for the right to vote. Some gave a little blood and others lost their lives. Some of you have heard me say that the right to vote is precious, almost sacred. In my heart of hearts, I believe that we should make it simple and convenient for all of our citizens to be part of the democratic process.
On Thursday, the Supreme Court of the United States moved decidedly in the opposite direction of ensuring that it is simple and convenient for all to participate in American elections when the justices ruled 6-3 in Brnovich v. Democratic National Committee to uphold Arizona's voting restrictions. Writing for the majority, Justice Samuel Alito reasoned, quote, "The mere fact that there is some disparity in impact does not necessarily mean that a system is not equally open or that it does not give everyone an equal opportunity to vote." Now, in addition to making my head hurt, the decision comes as a blow to voting rights activists and Democrats who hoped the court might prove to be a firewall against the onslaught of restrictions that Republican state lawmakers have introduced, all in an attempt to make it more complicated and less convenient for many to be part of the democratic process. With me now is my friend Ari Berman, a senior reporter at Mother Jones covering voting rights, also author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. Ari, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hey, Melissa. Great to talk to you again. Thank you.
I'm so pleased to have you here, although I wish we were reporting on a different decision at this point. I know advocates are disappointed, but were they surprised?
They were not surprised, but at the same time, they were taken aback by just how severely Samuel Alito gutted what remains of the Voting Rights Act. Remember, the Supreme Court has already gutted the Voting Rights Act. In 2013, John Roberts wrote an opinion that said that those states with the longest histories of discrimination, like Georgia, Texas, no longer have to approve their voting changes with the federal government. That took away the most important part of the Voting Rights Act. Then Roberts said, there's still this other part of the Voting Rights Act, Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, that applies nationwide and is still in effect. Well, what did the court do this week? They gutted the remaining section of the Voting Rights Act and made it very, very difficult for minority voters to be able to challenge discriminatory voting laws in the future. So it's really been a 1-2 punch in terms of eviscerating the country's most important civil rights law.
Right. So let's talk about that disparate impact language, because I feel like we just had a conversation about disparate impact in the courts as recently as 2015 with the Texas Department of Housing versus the Inclusive Communities Project. And the court at that point upheld the idea that disparate impact is a relevant way for understanding when we've got racial discrimination. Am I understanding from Alito's decision that that is now gone?
Yes, he's basically saying the disparate impact standard, as it applies to things like the Fair Housing Act, doesn't apply to the Voting Rights Act, and that the interplay of current and past discrimination is not enough to strike down restrictions on voting, that it has to go beyond what he calls the usual burdens of voting, that it can't be a mere inconvenience making it harder to vote. And essentially what he's saying is there has to be flagrant, shocking, intentional discrimination, or else we're not going to strike down these kind of voting laws. And what Alito is doing is he's giving a tremendous amount of deference to states that are making it harder to vote, basically saying they can make it harder to vote if they're concerned about voter fraud, even if there's no evidence of voter fraud, while he's significantly raising the barriers that minority voters, communities of color, have to prove to be able to show that a voting change is discriminatory. And essentially, he's rewriting the Voting Rights Act, because in 1982, the Voting Rights Act was extended. And this is when they really wrote Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act into law. And they said that it's based on what they call the totality of circumstances. So you look at both past discrimination and current discrimination to figure out if a voting change is discriminatory. Now they've added all of these new tests that aren't actually in the congressional record. So for a court that claims to be opposed to judicial activism, they've basically unilaterally rewritten the Voting Rights Act, essentially out of thin air.
Okay. I have to say, I had a moment of sort of optimism around voting rights in the context of the 2020 election, when the pandemic forced us to make it actually easier to access the ballot. And you saw this surge in turnout, not just among Democrats, but Democrats and Republicans. And I thought, huh, maybe this can once again be a bipartisan effort to say, actually, we want to get everybody out to the polls. Why are we still seeing Republican state lawmakers wanting to restrict access?
Well, I was hoping for the same thing, because we saw the highest turnout in 120 years in 2020. And I think one of the reasons we saw the highest turnout is because people had more options to vote than ever before. Mail voting was expanded in a lot of states. Early voting was expanded in a lot of states. And of course, there was still traditional in-person voting on election day. And so people had three options to vote in virtually every state in the country, which made it very convenient to be able to vote even in a pandemic. And I was hoping that would become the new normal. And Republicans would say, yes, we narrowly lost the presidency, but Donald Trump got more votes than any other Republican presidential candidate. We narrowly lost the Senate, but we're in good position to take it back in 2022. We have control of all of these key states. We can win in a high turnout election. Instead, what they've tried to do is institutionalize the big lie pushed by Donald Trump. And after overturning an election, they are now trying to change the laws to try to essentially achieve the same outcome, that it's too difficult to overturn an election after the fact. So let's just change the rules during the normal legislative process. And that's the kind of thing the Supreme Court has basically said, we're okay with. We're not going to let Donald Trump steal the election, but if Republicans want to change the rules to benefit their party, we're okay with that kind of thing.
So let's talk about these Arizona rules specifically. I know there were kind of two big ones. Can you walk us through it a bit?
Yeah, so there were two laws that were challenged in Arizona. One was a restriction on ballot collection, basically saying that nobody except for a family member or caregiver can return someone's mail ballot for them. And then there was also a restriction on out-of-precinct voting, that if you show up at the wrong precinct, your vote is thrown out. These disproportionately affect communities of color, in particular Black, Latino, Native American voters. They're more likely to live in areas that don't have access to polling places or access to mail services. And so they need more help when it comes to voting. But the big significance of the case wasn't the Arizona restrictions. It's what it means for all of the states that are passing new restrictions on voting now. Because remember, Democrats and civil rights groups have litigated against Georgia, Arizona, Florida, et cetera, under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. And basically what Samuel Alito is saying is it's going to be extremely difficult for you guys to win these cases. And it basically sends a message to Republican lawmakers all across the country. They can do virtually anything they want to make it harder to vote, as long as it's not incredibly flagrant and obvious to everybody. And the court's not going to strike it down.
Okay, so let's walk through the Section 2 one more time, just for folks who may not have been following all the aspects of the Voting Rights Act. So when in the Shelby v. Holder, in that case, it made it so much more expensive, basically, in terms of time, energy, effort, actual resources, right? Because instead of preclearance, you had to actually bring suit. But what you're suggesting now, I just want to be sure I've got this right, is that even if you go through all that time, energy, expense, get the litigants, bring the suit, that what would normally or would have previously been understood as a rationale for turning back these voting rights restrictions, that basis no longer stands?
Yeah, I mean, we have to see how this is going to play out in future cases. But basically, the way it worked now is, yes, you had to go through very lengthy, costly, after-the-fact litigation to challenge voting restrictions under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. That said, civil rights groups did have some success doing that. They were able to strike down discriminatory voting laws in Texas, in North Carolina, in some other places, using these remaining provisions of the Voting Rights Act. And now what Samuel Alito is saying is that he's going to give great deference to states that are passing restrictions, and he's going to make it much harder for communities of color to challenge these kind of restrictions. Not impossible, but he's added so many new barriers to being able to win these cases that it's going to be functionally very difficult to win the lawsuits that have been filed recently in places like Georgia and Florida and Arizona and other states.
All right, so if the lawsuits are a bit of a mess for a while, what are the other options for protecting voting rights? We do have some other branches of government. Is there something that the federal government can do through Congress, or something that state legislators might be able to do?
Well, I think this decision is just going to put more pressure on congressional Democrats to pass federal legislation protecting the right to vote, namely the For the People Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act. And I believe we're in a situation akin to 1965, where only the Congress can step in to stop the problem of voter suppression. Back then, there was no solution to the problem of voter suppression in places like Georgia and Alabama, other than the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And it's becoming increasingly clear that the only solution to the problem of voter suppression today is congressional action, because so many of the states are controlled by Republicans that are making it harder to vote. The courts have already signaled they are going to uphold these laws. That was obvious even before this Arizona decision, quite frankly. And so Democrats have to use the power they have to protect voting rights in the same way that Republicans are using the power that they have to make it harder to vote.
So can you help us to understand the difference between the For the People Act and the John Lewis Act?
Yeah, the For the People Act would institute democracy reforms that apply equally to all 50 states for federal elections. So it put in place policies like automatic voter registration and 2 weeks of early voting and a ban on partisan gerrymandering. And that would apply nationwide. And more recently, Republicans blocked a vote in the Senate, even on debating it. So it hasn't even actually had a real debate in the Senate. And then the John Lewis Voting Rights Act would restore the provision that states with a history of discrimination have to once again approve their voting changes with the federal government. And it would update and modernize that formula. And I suspect they are now rewriting it to also strengthen Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. And it's important to remember, Congress has the power here to set rules for federal elections and to write civil rights laws. They can overrule the court. There was a case in 1980 where the Supreme Court severely weakened the Voting Rights Act. There were people like John Roberts, who was a young lawyer in the Reagan Justice Department, who wanted to keep that weak Supreme Court decision. The Congress overruled the court in 1982 and strengthened the Voting Rights Act and renewed it for another 25 years. So Congress has the ultimate authority here. They just have to use that authority. Democrats have been unwilling to do it because they won't eliminate the filibuster to pass this legislation with 51 votes. As long as you need 60 votes, nothing's going to pass. But Democrats do have the power to pass these votes, these legislation, with 51 votes. They just haven't used that authority yet.
Yeah. Oh, that old filibuster. Ari Berman is a senior reporter at Mother Jones covering voting rights. If you care about voting rights, follow Ari Berman. Ari, thank you for taking the time.
Thanks so much, Melissa.
One week ago, this was me here on The Takeaway talking with WNYC's own Brian Lehr. So, Brian, let's talk about ranked choice voting. This is part of the reason, right, that we don't know yet who's won this primary.
Correct. And they're saying probably the week of July 12th.
July 12th. How young and naive we were last week. The New York City Board of Elections is now suggesting that the week of July 30th is more realistic because the board has had some, let's call it computational challenges with ranked choice voting, the system being used in the city for the first time in decades. Now, if you are not a New Yorker and have not been bombarded with a year of PSAs, take a listen to this little explainer from Fair Vote about what ranked choice voting is.
Ranked choice voting is another voting method which allows voters to rank their candidates in order of preference.
Now, according to Fair Vote, at least 20 jurisdictions, including Maine and Alaska, now use ranked choice voting. But New York City is the largest jurisdiction to use it. And the biggest, yes, but maybe not the most proficient, at least not yet. For more on all of this, we're joined by Christina Greer, Associate Professor of Political Science at Fordham University, co-host of the podcast FAQ NYC, and author of the book Black Ethnics, Race, Immigration, and the Pursuit of the American Dream. Chrissy, it is so great to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's just start with a couple of basics. You heard the beginning there of a ranked choice explanation. Again, for folks who haven't been living in New York and bombarded by the PSAs, tell us a little bit more about it.
Well, we as voters decided that we would implement ranked choice voting in our municipal elections because in other cities, say Minneapolis and San Francisco, it's supposed to help, say, non-traditional candidates become competitive. So it's helped women and candidates of color, female candidates of color actually have a chance at the ballot, this allows you to say, well, I like Melissa, and I also like Chrissy, and I also like this person and that person. So you can rank up to five individuals depending on how many you like. Now, it gets a little tricky because some people went to the ballot and only voted for one person. Some people voted for three, and some people voted for all five. We also had 13 official candidates on the ballot and a write-in option, so it was quite a bit. We also did not talk about ranked choice voting that much in 2020 because the Board of Elections was afraid that it would confuse voters since we did not use ranked choice voting in our presidential election in November of 2020. So the educational piece, we know many voters only pay attention, say, the month before the election, and much of that information was written if you went to the polls. But we also know that there's a fair percentage of New Yorkers who don't read in the language they speak. And so there was a question as to whether or not people would fully understand this new system, which is quite different from the way people have been voting their entire lives.
That said, people went to the polls, they made a choice, or three, or four, or five choices. And what's happening now isn't so much, it seems, about voter error, but about Board of Elections error. What's going on there?
Yes. So New Yorkers, by and large, those who bother to show up, and we have a pretty embarrassing level of turnout among the voting eligible population, even though it's better than, say, 2013 numbers, we still barely reach a quarter of voting eligible New Yorkers who participate. So the voter error wasn't there. However, the Board of Elections, which most New Yorkers will tell you needs a fundamental restructuring, they ran a practice test with roughly about 130, we call them dummy voters, right? Fake voters that they sort of run in a simulation to make sure that the system is working. Well, when they put in the calculations from June 22nd, they forgot to take out that 130 dummy voters. So when they presented some of the new tabulations, which were still preliminary, so even what they're telling us is still preliminary because we still have yet to count almost 125,000 absentee ballots. But many candidates noticed discrepancies about the numbers of people in the voting pool. So they raised an alarm. The Board of Elections said, oops, we made a human error, which is we forgot to take out these 130,000 fake voters. So obviously, I don't think that there's malicious corruption intended. However, we know a mistake like that erodes confidence among voters, especially if their candidate is not winning.
Hearing something like there were 135,000 fake voters, right? Sort of like while you're paying the bills and trying to get out the door in the morning and all of that kind of thing, can so undermine trust in institutions at a time that we desperately need to be rebuilding trust.
Absolutely. And we had 4 years of a president who stoked those flames. And so we have to remember that incompetence is not fraud necessarily. And what I think we're looking at right now is just sheer incompetence. What further complicates this narrative is that because of our absentee ballots, those individuals who decided to mail in a ballot were allowed to have their ballot postmarked by June 22nd. So we were waiting a full week for all of those to roll in. So we still didn't know a full universe of who voted on election night. So every result we've had thus far is incredibly preliminary because they're adding in the voters who voted early, such as myself. That's a relatively new phenomenon in New York, allowing voters to vote up to 10 days before the election. We're adding in those who decided to vote on June 22nd, which was Election Day, and also now we're adding in that third group of people who have absentee and affidavit ballots that were allowed to come in on June 29th.
I want to go back to our graduate school days for a minute here, and Chrissy, and say, you know, were you handing out the early, like, bivariate tables, you know, to your advisors? Like, I don't know about this releasing of early results. Why not just wait until there's an answer?
Exactly. And so, I mean, you were spot on, Melissa. Why would you slow drip the results? Because we know they will change. And so, or they might change. We don't necessarily know that they'll change. But I think that system further erodes confidence. Why don't we just wait until we have everything together? I think the rationale behind the Board of Elections is such that so many New Yorkers are accustomed to getting pretty good results on election night. But we knew that because of absentee ballots coming in up until June 29th, we would not have an answer for voters on election night, by and large. There's a 99% chance that we wouldn't know. And so it's more important to get it right than to get it fast. But there's been a lack of communication. So sadly, the Board of Elections has taken to Twitter communication with voters, and there's several hours where they just don't communicate what's going on. So again, this slow drip of preliminary results confuses many people. And then you add in what I think could just be, you know, an honest mistake of human error, but it is further eroding confidence as time goes by. And many New Yorkers are not used to waiting a month, possibly more, before they know who the next mayor of New York City will be.
Accuracy is more important than speed, and stay off of the Twitter machine. Advice from Christina Greer, an associate professor of political science at Fordham University and co-host of the podcast FAQ NYC. Christina, as always, lovely to talk with you.
As always, Melissa. Great.
There are four questions Jews ask to mark Passover every year. This Passover is leading many of us to ask more questions, once tied to our identity as Jewish Americans. I'm Matt Katz, and on the next Notes from America, we'll talk about hard conversations happening in Jewish communities right now, how we can heal our divisions, and why this Passover feels different. Available wherever you get podcasts.
Yeah.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry in for Tanzina Vega, and I just want to warn our listeners that we're about to have a conversation about sexual violence, which may be disturbing to some of you. On Wednesday afternoon, I was, like millions of other Americans, just living life, working, picking up my kid from camp, thinking about dinner. Then my phone buzzed with a news alert.
Breaking news, comedian Bill Cosby walking out of prison today after a court vacated his sexual assault conviction, saying Cosby's rights were violated.
We love you, Mr. Cosby! We love you, sir! We love you, sir! We knew it! We knew it! We knew it!
Cosby's release and the way that some of his supporters reacted transformed a regular afternoon into one of those days. Now, those days when a song or a smell or a date on the calendar flips a sad and angry switch inside of me. And of all the residual trauma that rape leaves behind, it is having those days that I hate the most. On Thursday, Jamie Floyd, the senior editor for the Race and Justice Unit at New York Public Radio, joined me here on The Takeaway. And as part of her helpful legal analysis, she also offered this insight.
This is why talking about the Cosby case matters. It's not because he's a big celebrity, but the reason it matters is for the reasons you just stated. We have victims here who allege horrific things happened to them, and the system they feel is failing them. But as you point out, there are so many black and brown men in prison who have intersected with the criminal justice system in ways that have failed them.
At that moment, Jamie's insight made it clear that we need to talk about it. And I don't mean a review and a reprise of Mr. Cosby's case. We need to talk about what it means for black women who are survivors. See, black men and women experience racial violence at the hands of the state. Michael Brown and Sandra Bland, George Floyd and Breonna Taylor. But black women also endure routine and systematic violence perpetrated by black men. Black women only very rarely do to black men what Anita Hill experienced, what Janae Rice and Rihanna endured, or how Megan Thee Stallion was allegedly harmed and then gaslighted. And of course, the vast majority of black men are not rapists. But of the 1 in 5 black women who survive rape, the overwhelming majority of us will suffer that violation at the hands of a black man. Black men are our fathers, our brothers, our sons, our partners, our friends. They're our aces, our besties, and the land where we plant so many of our dreams. And at the same time, black men are a source of suffering and violence in our lives. And this brutal duality renders many black women silent. For every 15 Black women who survive rape, only one will report it to law enforcement. I mean, sisters, we refuse to call the police even when we've been hurt because we so clearly understand the deadly consequences of reinforcing white supremacist lies about Black men's brutality. If there are Black men listening right now with tight jaws and clenched hands, ready to remind me of all the burdens that brothers bear, I would just ask you to pause for a moment.
And if you say, no, all lives matter, what I would say is, I believe that you believe that all lives matter, but because I live the life that I live, I am certain that in this country, not all lives matter.
I'm 34 years old, and it doesn't feel like all lives matter.
Here's the problem with everyone who says all lives matter. They don't really mean it. Just look at our history.
See, when I say Black women's suffering matters, I need you not to say Black men matter too. We already know. What I need is for you to acknowledge that Black women have a right to publicly name and resist all the violence we experience. I need you to sit with me and listen when I'm having one of those days. To help me try to make sense of this moment for so many Black women is Brittany Cooper, a Rutgers University associate professor in the Department of Women, Gender, and Sexuality Studies, and author of Eloquent Rage, A Black Feminist Discovers Her Superpower. Brittany, how are you doing in the midst of this Cosby news?
Hey, Melissa. I am outraged and heartbroken. And just, you know, and I was really flabbergasted with those that chose to support and celebrate this as though some kind of justice had been done, and frustrated as I perennially am at our inability to support and figure out pathways to justice for survivors.
And I think that was perhaps the most stressful part of that day to me, less about what happens in the courts, in part because I don't think of the courts as a space where much justice happens. But right. That feeling that somehow whatever we were experiencing as Black women who are survivors, or women who are survivors, or queer folk who are survivors, or boys and men who are survivors, that was irrelevant because of some like racial victory over the courts in this moment.
Yeah, we have to stop saying that because white supremacy has been so brutal and terrible to Black men that they are owed the right to rape and pillage with impunity. That to me is a perversion of what the struggle for justice has been. And one of the things that feels really obvious to me is that Black men should be reckoning with Bill Cosby and should be angry with him, because it is Bill Cosby and his actions that he admitted on the record, where he drugged and then raped women, that fulfills and expands and extends these terrible stereotypes about Black men as sexual predators. Bill Cosby knows about those stereotypes, supposedly built a career trying to challenge them, and then in his private life went around really acting as the sort of worst narrative about Black masculinity that the tales that white supremacy has spun about that. And so I don't know why the response from so many brothers is to be mad at Black women when really they should be angry with Bill Cosby.
So Brittany, I want to point out that perhaps the most famous or now infamous response in support of Mr. Cosby actually didn't come from a Black man, but rather from Felicia Rashad, his longtime co-star, and you are a Howard alum, and there was a lot of angst and anxiety about Dean Rashad's response, in part because she's been recently appointed as the dean, as one of the deans at Howard. Would you like to speak on that moment?
Look, sure. The thing that I would say is that as a Howard alum, you know, we revere Felicia Rashad and her sister Debbie Allen, but I was incredibly disappointed at the knee-jerk response to defend Bill Cosby when this was not even a well-kept secret. This was an open secret that he abused women, that he did it just as a matter of course. And so I appreciate the retraction, the statement she made saying that she would support survivors. I think she's going to have to reckon with this with Howard University students who are fierce and who have a gender movement on campus. And I think that reckoning should occur, even though I welcome her back to Howard for sure. But also, we've got to have a conversation about the ways that Black women and women more generally are sometimes complicit in patriarchy. For Black women, sometimes that pressure is about the fact that we have been put, you know, have the burden of always trying to put forward the best foot for the race, always trying to make sure that Black men are viewed as upstanding. We have been charged to be the keepers of our racial story and to be the keepers of our homes, families, all of those things. And certainly the Cosby narrative from his show has been a big part of that narrativization coming out of the last century. And I think that that is the legacy that she's trying to support. But what we are moving toward is not these facile narratives about Black respectability anymore, but really starting to say, let's talk about harm. Let's talk about the violence that attends to so much of our attempts to try to perform all of this respectability. That is where I hope that she will grow in her narrativization of this, seeing herself as a person who, precisely because of her gravitas, can actually help us to have a better reckoning with this story.
I want to talk for a second about justice, because again, I want to go back to what it means for Black women who survive any of a variety of aspects of physical and sexual abuse at the hands of Black men. And we often, I mean, overwhelmingly do not look to the system of criminal justice for justice, in part because we know it has rarely brought justice to Black women or to our larger communities and families. So if I want an abolition of prisons and I want justice, what is it that I want for rapists, for those who do harm to Black women?
Look, it's a hard question for me, which is why I tell people that I'm on a journey to abolitionism, but I struggle with it in part because I feel like everyone is asking Black women to sacrifice any notions of justice that we might get on the front end, because we recognize how unjust the system is to our brothers on its face. And I'm asking, what happens if we start from a narrative about what it means to keep Black women safe? But at base level, I think that in an ideal world, what we would have is a situation in which every single day, Bill Cosby would have to sit face to face with his accusers, reckon with what he has done to them, listen to their stories, fund therapy for life, think about the careers, the livelihoods, the joy that he has stolen, and then reckon in community with what does it mean to restore that? What does it mean to pay restitution for that? What kinds of doors should be open for that? And then I think that it means that we got to have a community reckoning with what is causing men in general and Black men in our community context to enact power by violating and raping Black cis women and Black trans women. Why are they doing that? What is the appeal of being able to enact power on the vulnerable? And why don't Black men understand that when they are so often the victims of unjust enactments of power from white supremacy?
And even as we expect and await the work that brothers need to do, I'm also wondering how we might squat up for each other, how Black women and queer folk and survivors of all genders can hold each other on days like those days that so many of us had on Wednesday when we heard that news.
Look, I think that one of the things I've been thinking that I love that Black folks are doing is we're creating our own holidays. It's not just Juneteenth. It's, you know, July 16th is Ida B. Wells and Asada Shakur Day. We are creating our own holy days because we recognize the need for that. And I think that we really should be figuring out some days of mourning, some days of collective grief, some days where we can sigh together and wail together and scream together and say, you know, like, your blues ain't like mine, and look at the level of the weight that I carry. And I hope that we collectively figure out what does it mean to memorialize our need to mourn and to grieve and to be honest about all of the weight that we carry, because the inability to tell the truth about it is killing us. But I also think in the end, we got to just be crew and ride for each other, believe each other, listen to each other, protect each other. Don't continue to let this go around being an open secret that everybody knows, but nobody's willing to say because they want to protect their neck. That's not feminist. It's not solidarity. It doesn't protect your sister. And if they're coming for you in the morning, then they're coming for us at night. And we got to keep that ethic and, you know, and really, really decide what we're going to be in solidarity with. Is it our own safety and our own freedom, or is it this Faustian bargain with a freedom that's about, yes, overturning white supremacy, but then reinstantiating the patriarchy? That isn't freedom to me.
Thank you for that language of grief. I've been teaching 22 years now, and I haven't ever gone through one semester, not even one, where I didn't have a student who disclosed to me. And grief is the word that I have to use in that space. And I also just want to say thank you to you, because you have been my soft place to fall over and over again. You were one of the first people to whom I disclosed, and I appreciate you always being being my friend and being in my corner in those ways.
Thank you.
I love you too. Brittany Cooper, co-author of the upcoming Feminist AF, A Guide to Crushing Girlhood. Thank you.
Thank you.
On Thursday morning, a years-long investigation into the Trump Organization and its chief financial officer, Alan Weisselberg, came to a head when Weisselberg turned himself in to New York prosecutors. Weisselberg was in charge with grand larceny in the second degree. Prosecutors said he evaded taxes on $1.7 million of income. And in addition, the Trump Organization was indicted on 10 counts, including a scheme to defraud and four different counts of criminal tax fraud. Now, legal analysts are watching to see whether Weisselberg, who has worked very closely with Donald Trump over the years, will ultimately cooperate with officials to reveal incriminating evidence about the former president's business dealings. Trump and his lawyers have criticized the investigation as politically motivated because the district attorney and the attorney general leading the investigation are both Democrats. As for me, I'm getting my popcorn ready and just waiting for the Weisselberg Trump version of the 2019 Snitch Fest by rapper 6ix9ine, when the heavily tattooed rapper went to court and told all the business of his gang in order to skirt a life sentence. It just makes me giggle to think of the Weisselberg version of this viral Instagram post by the maligned rapper.
Y'all don't want to accept the fact that those is all true facts. Y'all understand why I snitch. Y'all understand. Y'all don't want to understand.
We're joined now by Rebecca Ballhouse, investigative reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Thank you for being here, Rebecca.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Oh, it's lovely to have you. So give us a little bit of context here. How do yesterday's events fit into the indictment process?
So as you said, this has been a years-long investigation now, and it grew out of this separate investigation into hush money around 2018. And grew to include a review of Trump's tax returns, a focus on bank fraud, insurance fraud. And what we saw yesterday was really a focus on these fringe benefits. And what prosecutors alleged in the indictment that was unveiled yesterday was that there was a pattern at the Trump Organization by both the company and by its chief financial officer, in which executives like Weisselberg would receive perks like apartments, cars, tuition payments for his family members' private school in Manhattan, and wouldn't pay taxes on it, and the company wouldn't pay taxes on it either.
So it ends up being the kind of income that isn't dollars in the bank, but has these kinds of benefits on top of.
That's right. And so, and you know, as you said, prosecutors said that Weisselberg avoided paying taxes on $1.7 million in income since 2005, which is a pretty eye-popping number.
Now, tell us a little bit about the role that Weisselberg played in the Trump Organization.
So Weisselberg is one of Trump's closest confidants. He's worked for the company for nearly 50 years. His son worked for the company. And the way that former and current Trump Organization employees and others who are close to the former president and to the company have described him is that he's intimately involved in several aspects of the company's finances, and that he and Trump, you know, would go over all the checks that needed to be signed at the end of the day. Corey Lewandowski, who was Trump's former campaign manager, I think once described him as knowing about every dollar that went out the door. So he's somebody who's really involved in a lot of aspects of how that company works and is also personally very close to Trump.
So was it surprising he turned himself in?
That's just sort of how this works. I mean, he was charged yesterday. He pleaded not guilty. His lawyers have said that he plans to fight the charges in court. you know, this is part of this larger effort by prosecutors to get Weisselberg to cooperate, which so far he has refused to do. And I think that it really remains to be seen whether the charges that were released yesterday are going to be enough to force him to cooperate. The charges that he's facing carry a maximum prison sentence of 15 years. So it's possible that if he's, you know, looking at the possibility of spending time in prison, that he's going to choose to cooperate with prosecutors. But I think at least so far, we're not publicly seeing any shift in his stance. And so I think it's still very much an open question whether he's going to kind of change course here.
So you just said that we don't see a shift in his public stance, Mr. Weisselberg's. Do you think that others within the Trump organization and perhaps former President Trump himself are feeling nervous, though, at this moment?
So we know that the investigation is still very much ongoing. We know that they're still seeking to build a case against Trump. And we know that in addition to trying to gain Weisselberg's cooperation, they're also trying to persuade others of the Trump organization to cooperate, including the chief operating officer, whose name is Matthew Calamari. We reported a couple of weeks ago that Calamari has also been under scrutiny by prosecutors for these fringe benefits that they say he received. He was mentioned, though not by name, in the indictment yesterday as an employee who received, you know, an apartment and a car lease from the company and didn't necessarily pay taxes on it. So we know that they're still very much working on trying to get people to cooperate with them. It's just not clear yet, I think, whether that's going to happen.
So does former President Trump have a point that this seems to be politically motivated?
On the one hand, I think he has said that about every investigation that he's faced since running for president. But on the other hand, I think what we have heard from legal experts and former prosecutors is that it's somewhat unusual to bring a case that focuses solely on fringe benefits. It's often a part of a larger case, but it's a little bit rare to bring a case that's just on that subject. On the other hand, we did see some legal experts say yesterday that they felt like the charges were actually more sweeping than they expected, and that they portrayed a slightly more brazen scheme to avoid taxes than people might have anticipated.
What does this mean for the business of Donald Trump and the Trump Organization?
So practically, if the company is convicted, they could face fines, they could face other penalties, but, you know, it doesn't mean necessarily that anyone goes to prison if the company itself is convicted. But more broadly, an indictment against the company can really make it difficult for the company to do business. And this is coming at a time when the company has been somewhat restricted in what it's been able to do while Trump was in the White House. And this was very much a time, I think, when they were looking to expand and possibly looking to expand more abroad in particular. And, you know, if they're facing now these charges, if they're going to be in the news every day about this case for the next several months, I think that certainly complicates that effort. And there's also this separate question, I think, of, you know, their dealings with banks. Do banks try and call in outstanding loans early? So I think that there's a number of issues that the company needs to consider right now.
Is there a possibility that former President Trump himself is going to face charges?
I think that really remains to be seen. It certainly, he was not mentioned by name in the indictment yesterday. We know that prosecutors are very much looking to build a case against him. And we, you know, were certainly told that there wasn't much that happened at his company that he didn't know about in terms of whether he was aware of the conduct that was described in the indictment on Thursday. But it's still very much an open question whether they're going to charge him.
Help me us to understand a little bit about the timeline here. I presume that we're not expecting these indictments to stop with Weisselberg, that there may be some other folks sort of, are we talking about across the summer, coming very soon? What are you hearing?
We don't currently, I think, have an expectation of when another round of indictments might come. And I think, you know, it definitely hinges on whether Weisselberg or others decide to cooperate. So we know that they're continuing to investigate, for example, whether Trump and the company were manipulating the value of the company's real estate to get loans and other tax benefits. We know they're continuing to look at these fringe benefits. So there certainly could be more, but I don't think we have any sense of the timeline on when more would come just yet.
Thank you so much to Rebecca Ballhouse, an investigative reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, y'all, we've covered a lot of ground today, and we really appreciate you spending part of your day with us. Now, a special and a bittersweet thank you to our line producer of today's show, Patricia Jacob, who is moving on after 2 years with us at The Takeaway. Patricia is a brilliant mind and one who can take any idea from just like a tiny sprout to a full sunflower. She's been a big part of The Takeaway team and one of the people with the kindest heart that you'll ever meet. We love her. We'll miss her a ton, and we're wishing her all the luck with her new adventure. Congrats, Patricia. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway.